the Buddha, it's the Dharma, it's the Sangha. We're on page 163. This is simply entitled The Lord of the House. The Master says, "The Lord of the House remains eternally in meditation, in eternal training, unmoved, unhasting, silent. All creatures are born and die as the world understands death. None impedes the Lord's work. Like the Buddhas and ancestors of old, the Lord helps and teaches at all times just by being the Lord. He, she, it is not a being and is not a being. He has no specific gender, no specific form. He is not emptiness, and he is not emptiness. We are born here, die there, born to joy or sorrow accordingly as we cleanse ourselves from our karmic impregnations. The Lord waits and waits eternally. Why? I am not a god. It is not enough for me to know the Lord of the house. More I neither seek nor ask. Neither ask nor seek. The Lord of the house has no beginning and no end, no past and no future. I am not him, and he is all of me. For centuries, people have caused Buddhism to suffer under the belief that it was a way of life and not a religion. This was because they feared saying the truth, lest they set up a god to be worshipped. The Lord is not a god, and he is not a god. He is not a savior. And if at the moment of death a person can embrace infinity instead of his own delusions, he is immediately united with the Lord. At all times we are free to unite with or turn away from the Lord. If you would know the Lord, know that the means of training are a thousandfold, but pure meditation must be done. Through meditation we are immediately united with the Lord. Together with him we go out into the fullest emptiness, into form and again into that same emptiness." And it ends with dot, 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 and so on. Into form, into emptiness, and so on. Back into form, back into emptiness. The in and out. The out is in the out into form, the in, back into the oceanic stillness of pure meditation. Deep samadhi. I read that just straight because I'm going to talk about it a bit, but there's some things you just got to read and marvel at, and this is one of them. You know, I will say some things, but I can't either add to or detract from what's said here. Rim Basel says it's the best. Description of the eternal that he's ever seen, and you know, it really is that. It's just exactly that. The chief thing I have to say about it is just one thing. That is, what is this a description of? You know, what is this a description of? What is the thing that isn't said here that looms in the background of everything that's said here? What is the thing that looms in the background of everything that's said here and yet is not mentioned? It's love. The word love is not mentioned here. And yet this is the best description of what love truly is you'll ever see. the most peculiar thing to the mind that knows love only in connection with clinging and with possession, with owning, with possessing, with having the beloved in some way. With another way to put it is that with the mind that knows love only in reference to self, the description of no self can very easily sound cold and remote and not like love. It doesn't the eternal care. Listen to what she says. All creatures are born and die as the world understands death. None impedes the Lord's work. Later on, she says, we are born here, die there, born to joy or sorrow. Accordingly, as we cleanse ourselves from our karmic impregnation, the Lord waits and waits eternally. When we think of love, so often we think of the love that we give, or we think we give, and the love that we receive. We think of it kind of like a commodity. This love is not a commodity that is given and received, that is owned or not owned. It is infinite love, and it, as I've said so many times, so many Dharma talks, it doesn't know how not to love. Therefore, the ideas of self that self has about love just kind of bounce off it. It can't not love. And therefore its love, from the point of view of self, can look not like love. It waits and waits eternally. And every need, every genuine spiritual need, is going to be met one day. In some context, somewhere, in some cosmos, in some life, in this life, perhaps, in another life, this need arises and passes in accordance with causes and conditions, in accordance with the law of karma. The need is built up and accumulates in accordance with the law of karma. The need is cleansed and converted in accordance with the law of karma. None of that impedes the Lord's work. What is the Lord's work? To be infinite love and infinite wisdom. To always be there when we turn towards it. To never turn away. To never judge. To never despise. To never look down upon anything. The bacterium, the ant, the spider, the scorpion, the shark, the demon, the diva, the angel, the man, the woman, the god, the devil, whatever may exist is all the same to it. It all arises and passes within the context of an infinite love. Whether we are aware of that fact or not is not the problem of that love. That's our problem. The Rebbe Master used to say, and I don't remember her ever saying it before 76, maybe she did, but after 76, she would often say, the truth does not insist upon truth. The real truth does not insist upon truth. The real love does not have to force it on anyone or anything. It can just sit still, be still, and be available when we turn towards it. When we get unconfused enough to turn towards it, well, there it is. There is the help. Then what is described in How to Grow Lotus Blossom, that which is described in it, the actual process that is described, and it is, and it is so perfectly encapsulated, distilled down in the five columns, that process can happen. The wheel will turn in the right direction, the direction of enlightenment, when we really wish it to. And it's not the problem of the eternal, of the Lord of the house, which direction we turn it. It will love us equally. I've told that story about how I was walking in the cloister. This is within a couple of years of my Kensho in 1977. And I'd been having the kind of typical waves of confusion and pain and that so often happen when the kind of the lid's been kind of pulled off the can, and the kind of next kind of level of training is manifesting, so I would just erupt. I didn't understand. I myself didn't understand what I was happening with me. I'd get very angry, very confused at times, and it would pass. And Rin Master was just very patient with me. I was walking with her in the cloister one day, and I just said to her, "I just want to thank you for your kindness." And Rin Master didn't even look at me. She never paused. She just kept walking. She just said, "How can I do harm to that which is part of myself?" And in that, she was simply expressing the training of a human being who is just quietly training herself to be as much like the eternal as she can be, knowing that she is not the eternal and that there is nothing in her that is not of the eternal. Because what she expressed there is the way the eternal is towards everything. How can I do harm to that which is part of myself? That's love. That is true love. She's not saying, you know, your problems are my problems. That's soap opera. My problems are my problems. Her problems are her problems. And I am not her problem. She is not my problem. Each man his karma makes and must carry for himself. When we accept that fact, we accept that we are not God, that we are subject to both physical and spiritual laws, and we are willing to work with the system, as it were, instead of fighting it, then we start to see love in abundance. We start to see love in the very functioning of the spiritual laws, such as the law of karma, that previously we had in some way fought against. We come to see love in the very limits that previously we resisted or attempted to deny. This is all part of the process of conversion. Of course, the ox herding pictures are one of the ways this is described. And what is that? It's called taming the ox. The ox is the self. You know, when it's a wild ox, it runs wild and makes a lot of trouble. You know, an ox is a big beastie, by the way. It's like a two times cow. Ox is big. And when it runs rampant, it can make a lot of trouble. And it can be tamed. And then, well, what is it when it's tamed for the peasant cultures of Asia? The most useful of all animals. The animal that pulls the plow. Then it is patient, reliable, strong. It's not the Eternal's problem if I want to be a wild ox or if I want to be a tame one. It's my problem. Either way, I'm going to get the consequences of my actions. When I turn towards the Eternal for help, whether I be wild or tame, there the Eternal is. There the help is. The Eternal does not keep score. Man keeps score. Some people do. But the Eternal does not. All the past sins that we may think of as sins or past mistakes, they don't matter to the Eternal. There's no score keeping. This is how it is that people can have a sudden conversion and go from a state of great confusion, doubt, and misery and seeming incapacity to keep the precepts, and in a very, very short time undergo a genuine, deep conversion and become a different person. The Eternal's not keeping score. Whether a person undergoes such a conversion or not, there's still the consequences of their actions. It's always the consequences of our actions. Will we learn from them? Will we bow to them? Or will we resist them and deny them? It's up to us. It's not up to the Eternal. The compassion is in the process. The teaching, the help is in the functioning of universal law. She says, we are born here, die there, born to joy or sorrow. Accordingly, as we cleanse ourselves from our karmic impregnations, or do not, the Lord waits and waits eternally. Why? I am not God. She says, I don't need to know why. It is enough for me to know the Lord of the house. From the latter part of 76 on for years, this is one of the things where Master most frequently said, it is enough for me to know the Lord of the house. This is not talking about head knowing. It's talking about that blood and bones knowing. It's talking about that the inner certainty. Sometimes people think that spiritual certainty is just a matter of feeling. That when you doubt, you have certain feelings that go with it. When you have spiritual certainty, you have certain feelings that go with it. And that the feelings are actually what the certainty is. I assure you that is not the case. The certainty of the Eternal has nothing to do with feeling. It is direct, intuitive knowledge of one's true nature. It is sometimes, not infrequently, especially as people go deeper, not infrequently confirmed in feeling as in every other aspect of body and mind. You get confirmations that occur in feeling and thought and perception. What are these visions in Lotus Blossom? The confirmation and perception. What are the teachings but confirmation and thought? What is the bliss, confirmation and feeling? And none of that is the Eternal. And none of that is the pure intuitive knowledge of the Eternal. That pure intuitive knowledge of the Eternal, which is the very heart of what's called right understanding, that grows right out of pure faith. The knowing without knowing grows into the knowing with knowing. But it had to begin with the knowing without knowing. And if all of that is thoroughly confusing, which it may be to some people and not to others, all makes perfect sense to me, but it doesn't make sense to my head. It makes sense to something deeper in me. I remember when I was a new monk, I've told this story before, but it's still worth telling again. that I remember sitting at lectures where Master did. She was doing lectures on Uji, on what I think of as the flow of immaculacy. And I would sit there those lectures, and I would leave that room feeling like I had had a spiritual meal in my hara. And I would think, when I left, I'd feel that fullness from that Dharma talk. At the same time, I'd think, I didn't understand a word she said. That's what my head would be saying. I did not understand a word she said. And at the same time, I recognized I was in the presence of something wonderful. And that it was just being given. It was just pouring into me. Because I was sitting there meditating with my heart, and my heart and everything in me open to it. And what an inexpressibly wonderful thing, you know, to experience that when you're just a kid, you're mid-20s. That's just a wonderful thing. I wanted to again say a few words about the term the Lord of the House. Some people seem to think that Rin Master cooked this up. Rin Master did not make up anything in this book. The term of the Lord of the House goes back to Tozan and Sozan. Maybe further back than them, I don't know. It's pure Soto Zen. This book is pure Soto Zen. The Lord of the House is one of the ways in which the help side of our help need equation, it's one of the ways in which the help side is rendered, translated, when people translate Tozan's and his disciple Sozan's teachings on the five ranks. Sometimes it's host and guest, sometimes it's lord and vassal. The help side is the host or the lord. The need side is the guest or the vassal. And it's a powerful way of conveying the fact that I am not God and I have a refuge that is the eternal. You see? Because as long as the need is going around swollen-headed thinking that it's the center of the universe, it can't turn towards what the help really is. And when we talk, I've talked before about the five ranks, but after this set of talks on Lotus Blossom, we'll at some point in the not too distant future look at the five ranks again. And you'll see it, that dance between help and need, just expressed again, just as in the four columns, or the five columns, the same thing, the five ranks, it's the same thing. It's just that each time it's reborn in someone's experience, if there's a new expression, a new aspect is revealed, and it's the same truth. When it came up for me in 98, in the summer, fall of 98, it came up in those talks I did as what I thought of as the five aspects of meditation. It's the same thing. It's the five ranks, the five columns looked at from the need side. What I have to do to keep myself in alignment with the help. Ask sincerely, offer wholeheartedly, wait patiently, listen carefully, follow gladly. Each time it will come up in some unique expression. And then you can see, well, this is the same as these other expressions. Just revealing another of an infinite myriad aspects of something infinitely profound. Rin Master says, for centuries people have caused Buddhism to suffer under the belief that it was a way of life and not a religion. This was because they feared saying the truth with a capital T, lest they set up a god to be worshipped. This has always been the quandary, you see. If you set up a god to be worshipped, then people will turn that god into the, remake that god in their own image, and it will end up being a judge. Because what's the ultimate thing we do to ourselves that keeps the wheel of karma rolling? What the ultimate thing is that we judge ourselves. So we will turn God into a judge. We turn what God really is into a judge, and then it's not what it is at all. You cannot turn that infinite love and that infinite immaculacy, you cannot turn it into a judge. It doesn't do that. It isn't subject to my personal will. I can project whatever I want onto it, just as a disciple. I can project whatever I want onto my master. That doesn't make it the way I'm seeing it. It just means I'm seeing things askew. And this is what so often happens in religion. So one of the strategies to try to avoid that is to not posit a positive, not put out a positive expression at all, but to just kind of stick to something like emptiness, a term like emptiness. And this has become a favorite one of Westerners who are very afraid of turning Buddhism into some variant of Christianity, but who in doing so, actually, if you try to make Buddhism not something else, you still turn it into something else than what it is. Because Buddhism has to be what it is, not what we wish it to be. The truth is not subject to my personal opinions. That which we call the eternal, the Lord of the house, that which is our true heart, our true nature, the Buddha within, the cosmic Buddha, you know, on and on and on, it is. How I view it is not its problem. If you want to call it emptiness, it's not its problem. If you think of it as emptiness, it may become your problem. Just as much as if you think of it as a god, in the sense of a judge over, sitting over all of us, it may be your problem. It's very hard to turn towards emptiness and ask for help if you have a kind of a, if you're stuck with a very kind of a head notion of emptiness. You can, sitting still in the midst of the immaculacy of emptiness, there's no problem with turning towards it for help. You don't have to know what you're turning towards. We're never going to know the eternal with our head. There's no problem with sitting within emptiness with a capital E, as it were, and turning towards it for help. So long as there is true faith and you believe the help is there to be cried out to. It doesn't matter what label we put on it. It matters what we do. For myself, I have at times had it come up as emptiness. I've had it come up as immaculacy of emptiness. I've had it come up as all the terms I've used and more as well. I often have it come up as God, always with a capital G, and without any confusion in my mind about what that God is and what it isn't. For me, mostly it comes up as the eternal, because in the years right after my Kensho, that's the term River Master was using most often. She went from Lord of the House in 76 and 77, early 77. It became the Cosmic Buddha. Then the term she used most for a while, and then it went to the Eternal. Then after a while, it went to the Unborn, and that left me behind. I always stuck with the Eternal is what stuck with me. And yet none of the words matter in the least. And what matters to me is that I'd be walking around this temple doing something And now and then, out of the blue, always when I would least expect it, there's this rising up of love and gratitude. And this prayer of love and gratitude that rises up and flies to the eternal, straight to the eternal. And that is entirely of the eternal. It doesn't matter what you call it, how you think of it. Nothing matters. What matters is that it is. And we can come to recognize it in all aspects of our experience, in the stillness of meditation, in the compassion and love in our own heart, in our own sense of need and cry for help, in all the particulars of our daily life. Everywhere we turn, there it is. And if we willfully go against preceptful truth, we will blind ourselves to it. And that's the long and short of it. Either way, it's not its problem. It will always be there when we need it, if we turn towards it. If we don't turn towards it, the help is still there. We just don't avail ourselves of it. She says, if at the moment of death a person can embrace infinity instead of his own delusions, he is immediately united with the Lord. This is one of the things that just knocked me for a loop in Rebbe Master's teaching in the before 76 was one sesshin, the first monastic sesshin I went to at the Abbey. She did like two talks a day through the whole retreat, and she did them on the Wheel of Life with the pictorial representation of the Wheel of Life right there. She walked us through that, and she did them on the kind of the chart of the heavens and hells, I think is what we called it. And on that chart of the heavens and hells, there's a place I've got all kinds of pictures on it, and there's a place where if someone's looking in a mirror, and although I didn't get it with my head at the time, it's like I wasn't really getting much with my head at the time, but it didn't matter, I was taking it in, I was sucking it in with my whole being, and I was just amazed, by the way, these talks. I was just amazed that there was this wealth of teaching and someone who could explain it. But when she talked about a person looking in the mirror, she said, this is what we do at the time of death. We're shown our actions as in a mirror. And then, so often what we do is we judge ourselves, but we don't have to. We don't have to judge ourselves. She says, it's not the eternal that sentences us to heaven or hell. It's we who sentence ourselves. And here she's saying, we don't have to do that. We don't have to do it. No matter what we've done, if at the time of death we can simply open our hearts completely to infinity. Here I am, do with me what you will. No conditions. Unconditional surrender. Then we're instantly reunited with our true nature. There's nothing in the way of that which loves us completely and infinitely. And of course, if we have not made the precepts our blood and bones before we come to death, we're less likely to do this surrender at that time. we're more likely to be frightened and look down in our self-judgment, our sense of uncleanness, unworthiness. And that is what we do to ourselves. It's not what the Eternal does. The Eternal is not a judge. She says, at all times we are free to unite with or turn away from the Lord. You know, that's love. That's love. It waits, is willing to wait for that which it loves forever. Is willing to wait. It does not force itself upon us. When we turn towards it and are willing to undergo the very difficult process of the cleansing and conversion of karma, well, then there it is. And it's right there within that process. This is why a person undergoing the karmic washing, we're spending a lot of time in that second column, even though it can be anguish, it also is at the same time bliss. One knows the purpose for which one is undergoing this. Through meditation, we are immediately united with the Lord. Together with Him, we go out into the fullest emptiness, into form, and again into that same emptiness. She used to say, the Eternal is, the Lord of the house is, the fullest emptiness you can ever imagine. You know, true reality is the fullest emptiness you can ever imagine. The immaculacy of emptiness. You can be drawn far out into the ocean of deep meditation and be out there and with a sense of, even while you're just you still, you're being out there in that infinity of stillness, that infinity of compassion. And then when it's good to come back into ordinary daily activity, you're, as it were, deposited back on the shore to do that which is good to do this day. And there are two aspects of one reality: meditation and training, meditation and perceptual activity, the two aspects of one life of Buddha. It is not for me to query the conditions and not for me to query the cost of doing this. When we're beyond querying the conditions and querying the cost, then there's just the doing of it. The following of the Eternal in and out, out and in, for eternity. To the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha.